I'm Steve Lascalzo, and this is The Way. Welcome to This Is The Way podcast's reaction and discussion episode for Chapter 18 of The Mandalorian, Season 3, Episode 2. The title is The Minds of Mandalore. If you have not watched the show through that episode, stop now. Come back after watching. No one can complain about spoilers when choosing to listen to a podcast about an episode. And honestly, you shouldn't listen even when someone claims the episode is spoiler-free. You're not going to catch me making those claims. The closest we get to spoiler-free is maybe a preview episode, and even then, we're making speculations based on available trailers and rumors. I've been covering The Mandalorian since the debut of Disney+, and we go from previously on segments all the way through to credit deep dives, so if you want to listen, then stay tuned.
This is The Way.
This is The Way.
This is The Way.
This episode is about March 8th, 2023's episode, Season 3, Episode 2, The Minds of Mandalore. I've read that Dave Filoni is a big fan of Tolkien's works, and honestly, I am completely on board with Star Wars homages to The Lord of the Rings. Look, if Star Wars came first, then I'd be fine with Lord of the Rings treating the Witch King more like Vader and having Frodo carrying a lightsaber, but the sands of time fell differently. Tolkien's works came first. There are heavy vibes in both cinematography, direction in Chapter 18, not to mention some of the creature design, the quest itself, and dialogue. I know, no ring here. We're not talking about destruction, we're talking about rebirth, but we're talking about some precious metals going for a dip, and it isn't a far leap of imagination, at least, to think that Moria, the Watcher in the Water, Shelob, orcs, elves, hobbits, dwarves, I mean, choose your pick. Who's Din Djarin in this case? Bo-Katan Kryze, Grogu, and even R5.
I can't use an astromech. I need a droid that's rated for spelunking.
Spelunking? Where do you spelunking?
The thumbnail description and full episode description are the same and read, The Mandalorian and Grogu explore the ruins of a destroyed planet. Well, they left out Bo-Katan, but I do prefer when the descriptions not only are the same, but they're short and to the point. So, I like this. That's not the case for every series or season on Disney+. The runtime shows up as 45 minutes in parentheses on the Disney+ show page, but you know I like to check it out. If you press play, you'll get to the credits in a little over 39 and one half minutes. Skip to the first shots of racing and fireworks on Tatooine, and you can make to the credits in just over 38 minutes. 38 minutes, 6 seconds, I think. As I mentioned last week, concept art is back. The Alamites look different, I think, and there's less green glass on Mandalore in the concept art. There is a very Mines of Moria-like image of Din Djarin approaching the living waters of the mines. There's a good shot of the winged dog or dragon on top of the M1 as Grogu looks on. Then there are images of Bo-Katan looking out over the waters of Kavala, or Kalevala, and the gauntlet is parked on the surface, and there's a shot of the creepy bloodsucker droid, but it's just a red light eye in the concept art, not the creepy floating eye we see in the live-action representation. There are also skeletons hanging upside down in that image, prone, scattered in the barren cave in the battle image between the mech beast and Bo-Katan. The final two shots are one from the Sindarin campsite of Grogu, Din, and Bo, and then the entrance to the Pool of the Living Waters. There was no Mythosaur concept art in this one. I was very much looking forward to it.
Precious.
The end credits start with the director, so that's where we're going to start too. Rachel Morrison. She's best known for her work as a cinematographer or DP, director of photography. Sure, she held that title on Black Panther and was Oscar nominated on Mudbound, but it is her work on the 2015 movie Dope that is notable here. Why? The director of that film was Rick Famuyiwa, one of the Mandalorian Season 3 executive producers. Morrison does a great job with cinematic homages and color palettes and the use of dark and light, but she's the director, not just the cinematographer here. I'm sure she had a hand in the setups and the color temperatures and all that, but this may not have been an audition for her directing full-time, but if it was, I think this is the kind of successful work that leads to more from Disney. I would not be surprised if she got a shot at a Marvel show or more Star Wars. And next week is going to be Lee Isaac Chung's turn in the director's chair.
Very well.
Writing credit once again goes to Jon Favreau, and I mentioned last week, it sounds like he's going to get sole credit for every episode this season. Director of photography for Morrison was David Klein. He has worked on The Mandalorian several times, and the Book of Boba Fett as well, and he got his start working the camera for director Kevin Smith in Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy. I mean, I did not go through all the crew this week, and I don't know if there are more people like David Klein that I just missed, but as I mentioned, I'm going to try and limit myself to updating when there are changes instead of mentioning everyone every time. You can go through and pick, you know, out any position, any crew member you want, but I need to get moving, so let's move on to the people in front of the camera now.
Okay, then.
Pedro Pascal is the Mandalorian, but Brendan Wayne and Lateef Crowder are once again co-stars and listed over the concept art, so great choice to continue to honor those guys in that way. Bo-Katan Kryze is played by Katie Sackhoff. Amy Sedaris returns as Peli Motto. Her last appearance in that role was in the Book of Boba Fett finale. The Rodian customer is a costumer. Actually, Dawn Denninger does much more. Stunts, makeup, special effects work, costumes. She's listed many times as a fabricator on her IMDb. And what's this? She likes playing Rodians, apparently? She played the Rodian prisoner that gets killed in the series opener for the Book of Boba Fett, then a Rodian mom in the fifth episode of that series, when Din Djarin is riding on the transport ship to Tatooine and sees the little Rodian. Well, Denninger, I guess, played the Rodian mom in that. Leilani and Ariel Shu portray the Jawas, and they've played Jawas in The Mandalorian's previous seasons, the Book of Boba Fett, even Obi-Wan Kenobi. And that's really it for the cast. There are some aliens in a droid, but they're not listed in the credits, and I couldn't find reliable sources for who, you know, performed the performance capture or did the voices. So let's just move on and get to the show. Chapter 18, previously on The Mandalorian, starts with another reminder that Din Djarin has to bathe in the living waters beneath the mines of Mandalore in order to be redeemed. Then the armorer mentions the mythosaur in Bo-Katan Kryze, and she quenches metal by dipping it into water as she mentions how Bo-Katan's rule ended in tragedy. Finally, we see Mando heading to Bo-Katan's castle where he tells her he's going to Mandalore, and she says that it's dangerous and pointless.
That planet has been ravaged, plundered, and poisoned. There's nothing left.
Those are two different lines from the same scene spliced together, but the context is the same. It's just showing you, you know, what you're supposed to be expecting in this episode. And the opening of the show brings us fireworks during the day on Tatooine. On my second watch, I think that the camera is actually zooming in during the race onto Peli's hangar in the center. Also, by the way, it's Bunta Eve. That's a hut holiday. We heard about it in the prequel series in Phantom Menace, but the people love it, even though a hut isn't in charge anymore. We actually find out during the scene, Boba Fett is still in charge. Hey, look who's back, Peli Motto. She's scamming a Rodian with the help of some Jawas. I really didn't like seeing that. It makes me like the character less, but there's an implication she's unhappy working on the holiday. I don't buy that either. She's got no life outside of her hangar and her friends, if you can call them that. I mean, the Jawas and the droids that come to her, they seem to be her only friends. She's genuinely happy to see the Mandalorian and the ship landing in the middle of the docking bay. She asks right away about the little green guy. Grogu shows off his force leaping, the stuff he learned from Luke, and there are a couple of creatures that Peli Motto mentions. One I've never heard of. She says the N1 is purring like a nuzzle shrew. No idea. Second, we've seen Lerman. She says, leaping like a Lerman. Well, they appeared in the Clone Wars TV series.
Thank you, Wag-2.
Thank you. Our village would certainly have been destroyed without your protection. Father, I was just offering the Jedi our thanks.
Perhaps we do owe you thanks. But I still wonder, at what cost?
Peli talks about tuning up the ship, offers to put the astromech port back in, because as I speculated, Din Djarin came to Tatooine to find parts for IG-11. But since Peli and the Jawas say they're not going to find them, that means he's going to have to settle for something else. And the droid we saw in the trailers, R5-D4, is joining the party. It's been mentioned over and over, but I'm going to mention it too, because if I don't, I mean, who am I? This is the droid that supposedly chooses to break down for the good of the galaxy in A New Hope.
Uncle Owen?
Yeah?
This R2 unit has a bad motivator, look!
Hey, what are you trying to push on us?
If you ask me, that is a horrible choice by the Disney story crew to let that become canon. And it comes from a short story in a collection that from a certain point of view, A New Hope, I think, is the book. Well, Mando doesn't like that he's going to have to accept this droid, but he accepts he's going to have to make adjustments to his plan because he's got no other choice. He takes along R5. Now, why do they choose to leave during the fireworks, during the celebration? At the very least, he and Peli could go up on the roof and watch, or he could just, you know, bring the ship up and they could watch. I get he's in a hurry, but is he in that much of a hurry? Why not rest? Watch the fireworks. Stay the night at Boba Fett's even. Let Grogu experience a little bit of the universe. I mean, is it all work and no play for the kid? Din Djarin spends all of the Tatooine day working on this ship, taking care of Grogu. Then he heads out right as the party is really getting going so he can go to another planet that it is just starting its day rotation. Now, I thought daylight saving was awful for sleeping patterns.
May the Force be with you!
All right, kid. You ready for an adventure?
Peli Motto gives a may the force be with you goodbye when they leave. A little surprised that she's going to throw that into him. I mean, maybe she knows Grogu's, you know, using the force, I guess. Next scene takes us to the orbit of Mandalore, and there are some big storms on the surface. It's cloudy and green, but we're going to see that it might be mostly glass and not grass. Before they head into the atmosphere, Mando gives Grogu just a little astronomy lesson about the Mandalore star system. He mentions he's never been to Mandalore, but we get confirmation Mando grew up on the moon of Concordia, right next door. It would seem the purge that hit Mandalore also affected the moon of Concordia, although slightly less. Instead of being bombed out, we saw that it was invaded by droids. We saw that in flashbacks in an earlier season, I think season one. And then there's one more big reveal. Kalevala is in the same star system. It's an important detail, too. Mando points to it on the N1's star chart. That's huge, because it comes into play in this same episode. Din Djarin continues to give lessons to Grogu, and remember, R5 is an astromech, so is co-piloting. I mean, Peli Motto told us this much. But I have seen people complain about how simple these lessons are and how short they are. But they're not there to show him completing training as a pilot. This is just to establish he's been getting these lessons. As I understand it, we're not seeing a lot of the in-between moments. We're just seeing the ones that are important to the story. And these are just to show that the lessons are happening. It's not just lessons on being a pilot, though. Din Djarin is teaching Grogu the way.
It's Mandalore, the homeworld of our people. Every Mandalorian can trace their roots back to this planet and the Beskar mines deep within. And you know what? I've never been there either. I grew up there, on that moon, Concordia. And that's Kalevala, where we visited Bo-Katan. It's in the same system. A Mandalorian has to understand maps and know their way around. That way, you'll never be lost.
Pass on what you have learned, right? Entering the upper atmosphere puts them in a storm, and when they break through the clouds, it's clear, but we hear Mando tell Grogu, because of the bombing, instrumentation and communication are going to be difficult from the surface, and they got to be careful. Mando lands and immediately sends R5 off to take readings, but why couldn't he have just done that on the approach, right? Couldn't R5 have done that from the astromech port? And even if he couldn't he just do it standing right there? I guess the reason is time, right? He could have had him do it while landing. He could have told the droid to take subterranean air toxicity levels later. But I think Favreau was just going for brevity in the script. Or maybe he did write it. And maybe Morrison made changes. It's the kind of little thing that isn't a big thing. But I do feel it's the kind of thing that Tony Gilroy wasn't doing in Andor. He was a lot neater and a lot more wrapped in his storytelling. Well, wouldn't you know it, R5 goes missing. Mando goes to investigate. The creatures jump him while he's in the cavern. And I started to think maybe these are going to be mutated citizens. And maybe they were wearing masks or something. But we find out later that these are just humanoid-looking creatures that must have been outcasts for millennia. These are Alamites, we hear later from Bo-Katan. And they used to be outside the cities in the wastelands when Mandalore was great. That's a little horrible when you think about that. These creatures are how the Tuskens were treated on Tatooine in the original trilogy. And then we saw them reframed in The Mandalorian and the Book of Boba Fett. So framing them this way now, like these are clearly humanoid, but and they're scavengers, right? They're just trying to survive on the planet. But wow, I mean, they're the enemies. They're just, you know, attackers. Din Djarin heads back toward the ship with R5, finally gets the readings. It's breathable, not toxic. So he brings the child along on this dangerous journey. I'm not saying he did it wrong, but I'm questioning his choice of landing spot. Clearly, on the approach, he could have taken the N1 closer to the center of the city, could have looked for an old docking bay, or even touched down near the city center, which would have saved him a perilous walk. He could have opened things up with his blasters or something, you know, I mean, really cleaned a clear space. Now, I mean, I get it. We need a story, right? And we need some excitement. But the reasoning for not doing a little bit more preparation upon landing is a little weak. During the journey down into the sewers, the same ones, by the way, Darth Maul and his version of Death Watch used in the Clone Wars, we get to see more creatures. Dog-like ones with dragon-like wings. You know, it's been maybe a decade since the bombing, but nature is taking over. But this trap that this creature sets confuses me. I have to believe the creature heard commotion, then set up this trap, but it definitely doesn't seem fresh. The bait doesn't seem to make sense either, because it's almost completely covered with ash, but it could have been just missed. So if this crab spider thing was truly just waiting there for a long time, it's a really weird place to set up. Din triggers the trap by seeing and then picking up a helmet in a pile of ash. The creature closes the trap. Grogu was behind him when he started the dig out. But when the creature springs the trap, he's almost already in hiding. I'm confused as to why the script didn't just call for the creature to immediately find Grogu, send him off right away to see Bo-Katan. But the creature takes Din Djarin, injects something right away into his neck with a very large gauge needle, by the way. Mando should be dead. This is a poor choice of setup by the prop crew or animators or however they did it. And it's not just that one time either. The creature takes Din and puts him from the cage to a spit roast, basically. Then Grogu tries to rescue him, makes too much noise. Somehow Grogu then escapes quickly enough to get all the way back to the ship. Then from there, points to the planet that Daddy Din pointed to earlier, and so R5 helps pilot him back to Kalevala. All that while the creature's doing what? I mean, cleaning his gear? Din should be dead.
Let's get rid of him once and for all. Maybe I didn't make myself clear the last time. I want to be left alone.
Bo-Katan is frustrated that Din is back, right? But when she confronts the cockpit, it's Grogu. And she almost immediately melts. She asks where he is, Din. Where's Din? And or where's your dad? She tells the droid to download the Astromech data to find out where they came from. And both R5 and Grogu transfer to Bo-Katan's ship, the Gauntlet.
What happened to him? Download the Astromech, find out where they were.
And people just love to talk around this little guy, don't they? I mean, even though he can't talk, he gets them talking. I mean, he make a great therapist. She has a huge smile on her face when she's heading into the atmosphere of Mandalore. I mean, you cannot miss the shot. She clearly has a smile. That's clearly direction, like, look happy as you're going to your old, old planet. They land. Grogu starts leading the way. There's a weird intercut scene with R5 turning on a camera. Seemed completely unnecessary to me. Maybe it was just to transition between the shots. Bo-Katan and Grogu, they're heading into the tunnels. She's regaling him with tales of how beautiful the city was. It's almost as if she's telling herself to make herself feel better, but she drops a very Lord of the Rings-like line.
This was once a beautiful civilization. My family ruled it all. Now it's a tomb.
Roaring fires, malt beer, red meat off the bone. This, my friend, is the home of my cousin Valin, and they call it a mine. A mine!
This is no mine. It's a tomb.
Boy, I really hope she doesn't meet Boromir's fate. Grogu leads the way, and in mid-story, she instinctually pushes Grogu out of harm's way. And when she comes across the Alamite trap, there is still this ticking clock. Din Djarin is in real danger. But this is the scene where we hear the line from the preseason trailers about, you didn't think your dad was the only Mandalorian. And then it's also here we hear about the Alamites, how they're scavengers just trying to survive. But she kills the attackers quickly.
Did you think your dad was the only Mandalorian? Those are Alamites, and we were their next meal. They used to live in the surface wastelands beyond our cities. If they survived, I wonder what else might have to.
Did I mention how Mando should already be dead by now? I mean, I don't know how much time has elapsed, but just now the creature's getting around to turning on a pump. And he again uses an insanely large gauge needle to draw off Mando's blood. This creature seems to just be a red eye in this machine. Very Lord of the Rings, if you ask me. Let's call him Sauron. It almost looks like a hologram in the liquid goo, and it probably isn't a human eye, but it's a smart beast. It's probably more than an eye. There's probably a brain in there, but we don't see it. I'm going to just try and let logic go, because it's super creepy, and that's all we need to know here. Now, the pump is only operating for a very short time on screen, but the size of the tube and the amount of blood going out and the unsanitary nature of the procedure, I mean, it was written this way. It didn't need to be in order to be scary. So poor writing, but still, I've got enough goodwill for this series to let this slide as opposed to the outright sloppiness of the Obi-Wan Kenobi series. Bo-Katan shuts down the pump with a blast. Though she's getting beat, because now the creature notices she's there, right? And she's on the ground, she sees the Darksaber that Sauron, the Mecha Beast, had tossed aside from Din Djarin earlier. And she grapples it, turns it on, and then she General Grievouses him right to the stomach with the saber to shut him down. So I think that the red goo is the blood that he's been siphoning off. The red glue that goo that the eye is floating in, I think that's other creatures' blood. Maybe the Empire left it there to weed out survivors? Maybe it's been making do with Alamites since the population of survivors completely ran out? I'm pretty sure this has nothing to do with the Alamites. It wasn't made by them. We know the metal isn't Beskar because of how easily it comes apart at the sword. And I don't think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't think this is some kind of creature that the Mandalorian set up to keep the sewers clean, right? Sauron the Louse pops its own head off and heads to the large mech that captured Din, but Bo-Katan doesn't notice. She turns right to Din, and we get some cliche dialogue.
Din, I can't hear you. Are you trying to say something?
Behind you.
I'm okay with it, because the action is so good. Bo-Katan uses the Darksaber so well, I was sure that this scene was here telling us she is now the rightful wielder of the Darksaber. Maybe in time it will be seen as such, but it isn't here. I really feel like this scene gets saved by Bo-Katan, not just Mando. She makes short work of the spider crab thing, this time appears, cutting off the heads, done the job now. Even though we just saw it separate the head itself, by itself, and crawl off. Well, maybe it does know it's beaten, and maybe it's just going to wait and try to crawl away when they're gone? I don't know. Mando passes out. Bo-Katan could have taken him anywhere, but she ends up keeping him on the planet. She feeds him Pog soup, piece of garbage soup. He's never heard of it. Which she says is ironic, because most Mandalorian kids grew up on it, but he is quite the contradiction, isn't he? He's a Mandalorian that never saw Mandalore. He's a child of the Watch, so basically an exiled faction of an exiled faction. He's super into his creed, his religion, but he didn't know enough about it to know how to be redeemed, because he had to ask at the outset, like, what must I do to be redeemed? And then almost at every turn, he needs help. Bo-Katan, though, went from, I don't want anything to do with you, to now offering to show him the way. The way, right? This is the way to the mines and the living waters. And of course, you know, he did such a bang up job of finding it before, right? I mean, she could have really just said, all right, see you later. Or, you know, I really got to get going here. You want me to take the kid back? No, she is starting to give herself over to this, the purity of the quest, let's say. As they walk, they talk about Mandalore, her life, her father, but not her sister Satine, a former ruler of Mandalore, even though she didn't possess the Darksaber. There's irony in her life, as we heard from the armorer previously. We know Bo-Katan's rule was brief and tragic because it led to the Great Purge. That's not her fault, of course, or at least I don't think so. She talks about the fighting between the factions. It's been going on for millennia. But even if someone was to unite the clans now, it should be pointed out that even when there was peace, there was still infighting. So really, how long before the First Order comes swooping in to take advantage of that discord? That's on the horizon. Anyway, on the path to the mines, we see the entrance is very Lord of the Rings inspired. And then she raises this glowing, floating ball of light, which made me think about Gandalf lighting his staff in the mines. Now, is there a Balrog? No, but there is something lurking, right? Before they get to the water, she tells about how she took the creed for her father and made him proud. But it was all theater for her subjects, or their subjects. She's not a believer. He, Din Djarin, has shown every step of the way that he is. I have to believe every moment, every time she looks to him to see and tests him to see if he's sincere, he fulfills that, and that she sees it.
I would have liked to have known him.
He was a great man. He died defending Mandalore.
This is the way.
What are you looking at?
I'm not trying to ship them. You know, I'm not trying to make them into a relationship, but this is basically almost, I love you to her. He is showing her something she hasn't had in a long time. It's the very thing she craves. He gives her respect, and she's eating it up. They get to the water. Her demeanor has changed. Look, it almost feels like a date. They don't kiss. They didn't kiss. They don't kiss. But she is opening up to him. You have to listen to her the way she talks to him. She's offering to give him a grand tour. She reads the plaque near the waters.
Here you go. The living waters. Hold on. I want you to get the full tour. These mines date back to the age of the first Mandalore. According to ancient folklore, the mines were once a Mythosaur lair. Mandalore the Great is said to have tamed the mythical beast. It is from these legends that the skull signet was adopted and became the symbol of our planet. This is it.
It's not just the words she's saying, it's the way she's saying it. It's the look that she's giving in her face. I mean, she told Grogu, like, you know, what are you looking at after he basically said, I love you with, you know, this is the way in respect to her father. She's still no believer. But where she sees amusement in this childlike wonder and childlike faith that he has, he is in awe. He's close to redemption. He doesn't ask how. He doesn't strip from his armor. He does lay down his weapons. Even though we heard in an earlier season, weapons are a Mandalorian's religion, right? Or they're as good as their religion. Then he starts to give the creed. The smile she has on her face as he wades in. Look, maybe it's not Eros. Maybe it's Phileo or Agape or Storge. But it's some kind of love. And I feel okay talking about the different types of biblical love here because of the Bible verse that was on the glass. I mean, I think it's implied.
I swear on my name and the names of the ancestors that I shall walk the way of the Mandalore, and the words of the creed shall be forever forged in my heart.
He then disappears under the water, and I think the next moments prove that there's some love of some kind. He was reciting the creed, and I don't know if he planned on full immersion baptism, but he got it. She doesn't hesitate. Puts on her helmet, plunges in, heads right to the depths to save him. She goes all the way to rock bottom, or to the bottom of the lake, to save him. It was a nice touch. She turns off her light so she could see the light coming from him. Then she turns back on her light for the climb to the surface, and she sees a miracle. The lights come back on, and she sees a miracle. A living mythosaur in the living waters, alive and well. They've returned, and now the prophecy is put to the test. Mythosaurs aren't mythical. They are real. I never thought we'd see one this soon in the season, and I wasn't sure we would see one at all. But now that he's been redeemed in the living waters, will he actually be accepted? Or is he going to have to, like, take a selfie in front of the plaque or something? I mean, how do you prove you were there? And do you mention the mythosaur at all? Is this the beginning of some kind of love between Bo-Katan and Din Djarin? I mean, I think so. Maybe it's not romantic. It's some kind of love. Let me know what you think about it and what you have to say about the episode. You can send feedback, thoughts, ideas, comments to thisisthewaypodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit our Linktree site at linktr.ee/thisisthewaypod. You'll find This Is The Way Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at thisisthewaypod or on facebook.com/thisisthewaypod. And we're on YouTube now too.
Now that's using your head.
Please consider subscribing everywhere. Like our posts. Like our content. And please, leave positive reviews only. You know, if you can't say something nice, kind of, that sort of thing. I do want the audience to grow, but I want to do it naturally, organically, without paying for followers or without running ads. I just want word of mouth to be the way that this thing grows, and I need you to do it. So thank you for joining me for This Is The Way Podcast's reaction and discussion of The Minds of Mandalore, Season 3, Episode 2, Chapter 18 of The Mandalorian. I'm your host, Steve Lascalzo, and this is the way. May the Force be with you, always.